Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Almost 11 years after Al Gore released An Inconvenient Truth, he's back with an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. Many of his first film's predictions about climate change have come true. Shrinking ice sheets, rising sea levels, and a global rise in temperatures. An Inconvenient Sequel, the new film, documents riveting images of climate change around the globe. We see glaciers melting in Greenland, where over 12 meters of ice have been lost since 2000. We see flooded streets in Miami, Florida, the eighth most populous metropolitan area in the United States. Florida has more residents at risk from climate change than any other state. The filmmakers updated the new film after Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And at last night's screening in San Francisco, Al Gore said, "If Trump won't lead, we will." Well, the question is, will we? On today's Your Call, filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Shank join us to talk about An Inconvenient Sequel. It opens on August 4th across the country. Bonnie Cohen is co-director of An Inconvenient Sequel. She's an award-winning producer and director. She's also produced The Island President, a documentary that tells the story of how President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives is dealing with the survival of his country. And Bonnie joins me in studio. Hi, Bonnie. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. So nice to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by John Shank, co-director of An Inconvenient Sequel. John is an award-winning director of photography, and he directed and photographed The Island President. And John also joins us in studio. Hi, John. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Bonnie and John have made several incredible films. You can find more information about their work at yourcallradio.org. And again, An Inconvenient Sequel opens in the Bay Area on August 4th. Well, congratulations on this film. I saw it last night. It was really hard to watch. The footage was incredible. And I wanted to ask both of you, since you both worked on and made The Island President, which is also about climate change, you know a lot about this issue. But what changed for you, or what new information did you learn after spending a couple of years traveling the globe with Al Gore? Bonnie?
You know, it's relevant to think about why Al Gore wanted to make a sequel or thought about making a sequel now. He worked with Participant Media, which is the independent studio in L.A. that Jeff Skoll began, and they were responsible for producing the first film. They have been talking for a number of years about whether there should be an update to the film, what the sequel should concentrate on, and they settled on 10 years out because there was a kind of a calculus about that amount of time offering up interesting information about the predictions that had been made about the climate crisis in the first film. And that, coupled with the fact that alternative energy is so much cheaper now and easier to come by, and we actually are at a place in our communities where we can put it in place and use it effectively and cheaply. So the combination of looking for an update to the climate crisis, which unfortunately has gotten a lot worse. Climate-related weather events are really severe. We're seeing storms we don't recognize. But that, coupled with the fact that we actually can do something about it now, became a compelling reason to make the sequel. So as we traveled around with Al Gore for 2 years, we observed not only those two factors, but also the relentless work that he's been doing for the past 10 years. I don't know how many Americans really know what Al Gore's been up to since 2006 when he made the first film. And so we really wanted to get behind the scenes and, you know, roll up our sleeves and get at the work that he's doing that's so inspirational.
John?
Yeah, you know, once we realized, it's funny, when we first signed on to do this in July of 15, we went to Nashville, and the first order of business, Al felt that he had to brief us on the latest in the climate crisis and the latest in what's going on in what he calls the sustainable energy revolution that's going on. And so we sat down at his home for the 10-hour version of the slideshow. And we were struck by a number of things. By lunchtime, after watching the evidence that's piled up of Mother Nature screaming at us with her voice of, you know, sea level rise, ice melt, storm surges, hurricanes that are, you know, traveling over oceans, you know, degrees warmer than averages now with global warming and making landfall and causing destruction. We were just devastated. By lunchtime, we were kind of just ready to walk off a cliff. Mm. But he did something interesting. After we came back in the latter part of the day, he started telling us about the cost down curve in solar and wind and countries and communities in the world that are now using renewable energy, you know, in major ways that had not been true 10 years ago. And so we started thinking, there's actually a natural drama here that's sort of ready-made for film, which is we have these viable alternative solutions now. Will we, as a community, as a society, as a globe, get together and change our policies to move fast enough towards those solutions that allow us to, you know, hand over a planet that's healthy to our kids and grandkids? It's become a real emotional issue now.
It has become a very emotional issue, especially when you see the images for a good hour and a half. I mean, I have to say that one of the most powerful things about the film is we are inundated with so much information, and we get bits of news about floods and fires and these rain bombs that happened in Arizona or what's happening overseas. And you click on it, you watch it, you read a story about it. But what I thought you did so well is you connected the dots, and you're not on your phone. You're not distracted. You're so focused on this film, seeing all of these devastating things happening around the globe. I thought that was one of the more effective parts of the film, because you were able to realize, wow, this is new. This did not happen 15, 20 years ago.
Well, you talked about, John talks a lot about the user-generated videos that we now have access to.
Yeah, you know, one of the characters in the film really is the still photography and user-generated video that exists now, because people are seeing these, you know, what they call weird or strange occurrences that they haven't noticed before in their parts of the world. And so you see people pull out their cell phones and film floods, you know, on the kind of NOAA scale, or wildfires that are happening much more fiercely. In fact, today they're raging in our own state of California. And so unfortunately, the evidence is kind of there for the picking. We were in Greenland with Al, where you see him at the beginning of the film. Bonnie touched on this. One thing we really were set on doing in this film is going with Al to the front lines, and not just being, not just seeing him on stage delivering the slideshow, but actually traveling with him in the world where he gets his evidence and he meets with scientists in Greenland to talk about the latest in the ice melt up there. While we were there, a helicopter engineer said, you know, a colleague of mine recently pulled out his cell phone and filmed an event that we've never seen here in Greenland before, which was the glaciers exploding, you know, in the high temperatures that occurred in April, which is, you know, quite early for there to be warm temperatures in Greenland to begin with. But you see these almost kind of Hollywood level, it looks like special effects, but it's real. You know, these glaciers exploding under the high pressure and high temperatures, which are occurring regularly now in Greenland.
What was it like for you to be there when that was happening and to see that footage?
Standing with Al Gore in front of a glacier in Greenland as it melts and calves and falls into the ocean was really quite an emotional experience for Bonnie and me. We realized that we were standing there with this man who spent his entire career trying to stop just that thing that he was looking at. Of course, you combine that with the aching beauty of Greenland, and the ice sheets are, you know, just one of the wonders of the world, and we tried to capture that in the film. But then simultaneously, you're looking at that wonder of the world kind of literally dripping away and falling apart. It's almost like a virus is attacking it. And it's in that moment that Al says to us that, you know, he's doubling down on his efforts, and he's moved to work on this issue even more so every day because of what he sees.
And what was it like to also interview the people who are in Greenland 24/7 working on this to let the world know what's actually happening? One of the men in the film showed you the tents that were on the ice, and then showed you what happened after it was melting. And now the place where they sleep they're on wooden stilts because it's melted that much. I mean, these people dedicate their lives to this issue.
Definitely. The reason we were in Greenland is because Al wanted to go there to meet with very specific glaciologists that were doing work there. We visit a glaciologist's station called Swiss Camp, which is way out on the ice sheet. And, you know, this is a research station. There are about 25 of them all around Greenland. And the one we visited is the one that you describe, where the ice melt is so significant that they have to keep building the camp back up. But the reason we were there was so that Connie Stefan, the glaciologist, could show Al exactly what the markings were, how fast it was melting. He wanted to see it for himself, see how the moulins were rushing faster, and the ice was coming out into the ocean quicker, and to just kind of experience the kind of virus-like cracks in the ice. And he's there. It is, as John said, it was a very emotional experience, but he's also there tactfully trying to get the latest information to bring back to not only his slideshow, but also all the climate trainees that he trains around the world that are impacted by this. And, you know, it became very important for us to take that scene and marry it to the flooding waters, as you talked about in the introduction, that are happening in Miami Beach, Florida, because it's hard as an American citizen, as a citizen of the world, to make the connection for yourself between the melting of that ice very far from your home and how directly linked that is. That's the same water that's showing up on the streets of Miami Beach, Florida. So in terms of kind of a visual opportunity, we took advantage of that. So the next place that Al goes in the film is Miami.
That was another incredible scene, because The New Yorker had a story, I think it was maybe 6 months ago, about what's happening in Miami. Mm. But seeing it is a completely different experience. Yeah. And Al met with city officials who are trying to do something, but they admitted, we don't know what we're going to do here in the long term.
Well, it's adaptation they're trying to
right.
do. They're adapting to a new reality.
Right. And you also point out in the film that the governor of Florida wouldn't even meet with scientists to talk about climate change, as his city is completely flooded. And Al put on these boots, and the water was higher than his boots. I mean, it was that's how high the water was in the city of Miami.
Yeah, you know, Miami, in terms of assets at risk, is the largest piece of real estate holdings in the world that's going to be inundated by sea level rise if we don't act fast enough to reduce carbon emissions. And Al is in the film trudging through the streets of Miami Beach with Philip Levine, the mayor there. And as you said, it's kind of you know, it's almost it's pitifully sad to watch kind of the kind of half measures that are being taken to raise the streets a couple of feet, knowing that the sea level is going to rise, you know, maybe as much as 7 feet by the end of the century. Now some conservative estimates are predicting, and you feel that kind of poignancy, not just with Al, but with these city officials who are doing everything they can to try to protect their citizens, knowing that at the end of the day, adaptation is really not the answer. The answer is, you know, what they call kind of in the nerdy climate circles, mitigation, which is, you know, to keep this from happening in the first place, so that we can maintain the incredible civilization that we've built over 10,000 years.
Today we're speaking with John Shank and Bonnie Cohen, co-directors of the new documentary, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. It is Al Gore's new documentary, almost 11 years after he released An Inconvenient Truth. So many of the film's predictions about climate change have come true, even though we hear from so many conservatives in the beginning of this new film slamming Al Gore's predictions. And the filmmakers, Bonnie and John, had to update the film after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. So many of us are wondering, what now? I mean, last night Al Gore said, if Trump won't lead, we will. Will we, and how? If you'd like to join us, if you have a question or a comment for Bonnie and John, if you saw An Inconvenient Truth, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. 10 years ago, Al Gore launched a training program to teach people about climate change. It's a climate leadership training. And he started it in Tennessee with about 50 people. And now he's traveling around the world doing this. And that was really interesting to watch these audiences transfixed on what he was saying. And you just learn so much about how the temperatures are getting hotter. And the thing that I was thinking about is, you know that with this film, people at, say, the Heritage Foundation, all of these Koch brothers funded groups are waiting to just find one thing that's wrong in this film, because then they would snap that up. And I'm sure the same applies to these trainings, right? Everything has to be exactly accurate.
There is a tremendously rigorous fact-checking process that goes on. Al Gore has a team of experts that he works with, some he has on staff, that are combing all the time research, the latest research and science, and updating the slideshow with many sources attached to combat exactly this problem that you're talking about. And it's true, people come to these trainings who really want to change their lives and make a difference in the world. We had kind of an interesting experience traveling around with Al Gore, because many people who are doing the climate work right now, the important climate work, had been trainees 10 years ago, right after the film came out. The best example is Cristiana Figueres, who ran the Paris Climate Conference. She was in Al Gore's second training program. So the facts and figures are part of it. Learning how to kind of become a climate activist is also part of the training. And it's a really forward-thinking way to get involved. And if you want to do it in a serious way and make a career out of climate activism or getting involved with an alternative energy company, it's a great opportunity.
What struck you about being at the trainings?
Bonnie's absolutely right. You know, in a way, you know, documentary filmmakers are constantly trying to figure out how to build outreach programs for their films and make high school curriculum and get it into the schools, but also get into the communities and have it make a difference. It's kind of a dream for documentary filmmakers. In a way, Bonnie and I sort of had an ad hoc study on what can happen with a really powerful documentary, because we were following in the footsteps of this film that happened 10 years ago, and we met people in their 20s who saw the film as teenagers, but now we're working on the solutions. Yeah. We met a man right here in the Bay Area who was working in marketing. He saw the film with his kids, and he thought, wait a minute, I need to start working on solutions. Went to work for as a marketing in marketing departments of alternative energy companies, and ultimately started his own battery technology company. You hear these stories all the time, and it was so heartening. You know, when you add time to the mix, that people, you know, kind of take it seriously, and they ask themselves, well, what is it that I can do in my life that can make a difference? And with the advent of the cost down curve of solar and wind, it's becoming more and more real for almost anybody to ask themselves, what can I do in my home, in my workplace, in my community, at a local level, at a state level, to move my little section of the world faster towards renewable energy?
We also see so many examples around the globe where countries are embracing solar because, as you said, the costs have come down. In these trainings, you see the graphic of solar being so expensive 10 years ago and now incredibly cheap. And in Chile, they're embracing solar energy. That was an incredible part of the film. I hadn't heard about that. Can you talk about that, Bonnie?
Yeah, sure. As you mentioned, the cost down curve for solar is so exaggerated now. There's, you know, it's like pennies on the dollar. It's almost, it's kind of an economically viable solution all over the world. It used to just be that was true in the developed countries, but now developing countries that are getting the technology and the IP are able to get onto it and actually offer their citizens really cheap and effective electricity. And Al Gore gives the example of Chile in the film that has, you know, quadrupled their efforts to bring solar to the country. And he does this wonderful graph that just keeps expanding upwards and increasing and increasing and increasing, so that you see that there's just this overwhelming expansion of solar and alternative energy in that country. It's very inspiring, and Chile is just one example. It's happening all over the world. In fact, even India, which for so long thrived off of coal, right after the Paris Climate Conference, they were given a very sizable loan from the World Bank, and it's actually helped them, as a developing country, put more solar in place. And it's been really inspiring in the last few months, almost the last year. We found out that they've canceled a good number of their coal plants that were planned for the future. So there's really a shift happening as a result of the possibilities here for the technology to be put in place.
In the film, you also tell the story about what went on behind the scenes at the Paris Agreement conference, especially between the United States and India. What was that like for you? Because most people just don't know about the deals that are made. We think about it, but the phone calls that are made, things that are happening right under the minute, where you have one more day for all of these countries to agree to this Paris Climate Agreement. But there are lots of things going on where one country might not agree, another country is trying to get... I mean, it's just, you make phone calls. What did you learn when you...
Yeah, it almost played out like a political thriller for us. I mean, you know, we were specifically following Al Gore. If you imagine that what was happening with Al Gore, which you see in the film, is happening in lots of other rooms around that conference with other leaders.
Deals being made.
Wieldings, all sorts of things. He really comes to life because, you know, as a man who spent so much of his life in the political sector, and now he's for better or for worse a climate activist, but he also has a lot of contacts in the business and investment communities. He was able to kind of put on a very creative hat and think about what he could bring to the table to get India on board, specifically India on board, which was what he was tasked with. To bring them into the agreement. And he starts, you know, it was just amazing to see how he uses his resources. He reached out to his contacts at the World Bank. He reached out to John Kerry. He reaches out to people in the investment community. He talks to, you know, Larry Summers, who's the former Treasury Secretary of the United States, to try and think about just what might work to bring India on board, what they need to feel that they are being included in this conference in this agreement in a way that can actually work for them as a country.
I also appreciated that you quoted or you filmed a few activists from India who said, well, the United States has been doing this for 150 years, and now that they're ready to finally embrace clean energy, they want us to do it. Right?
Yeah, we have a scene in the film where Al meets with the Minister of Energy and another man, the Minister of the Environment in India, and they articulate to him this very commonly held thought from the developing world, which is, hey, wait a minute, we didn't really create this problem.
Yep.
It was the developed world that benefited from the Industrial Revolution that's been burning coal and fossil fuels for 150 years that got us into this mess, that put the carbon in the atmosphere, that created global warming, that's causing all these effects to happen around the globe. The new thing that's happened, and the other thing you have to understand, is that at these climate conferences, they happen every year in cities around the world. And the community that goes, the ministers and their staff that goes every year, they know each other. This is, you know, a few thousand people who've gathered every year for 25 years to try to get a deal done. And the passion runs high on both sides. Everybody wants to create a deal that's going to save the planet. That much is agreed upon. But the tension has always been, who is going to pay for it? But the interesting thing that's happened that's also related to the cost down curve in solar and wind and other sustainable options is that now the money is becoming less of an issue, and countries are realizing, hey, wait a minute, if we get on board, we can be part of the innovative job creating industry that's going to also help us, you know, move to a healthier planet. And so Al gets into the trenches with the Indian ministers and helps them figure out a way to take advantage of that, to find the financing and to find the intellectual property and the technology that could be transferred to their country to help them build these solar factories of tomorrow and be part of the solution. And you see them in the film get quite excited about that.
There's also a lot of passion outside of the deal-making rooms with activists and climate justice activists saying, excuse me, it's your neoliberal capitalist policies that got us in this mess in the first place. So what were the decisions behind including some of these comments, bringing in the activists that are butting heads with a lot of these world leaders who got us into this mess?
It's a very complicated problem, which is why there hasn't been a deal at one of these COP conferences until this one, 2015. There's a lot of blame that gets thrown around. There's a lot of misunderstanding about who deserves what. And actually, in credit to the French for the first time, for not trying to make the deal have to be all-inclusive. In other words, every country has to agree to the same goals. There was an effort that the French government made to kind of, you know, customize what the commitments would be country to country, so that actually overall we could get to a place of agreement. And even in that situation, which is an accord that happened at the end of 2015, it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And many of the activists know that. A lot of the climate scientists know that. But I think from, you know, in the political realm, and sort of where Al Gore was coming from as well, we believe, is that at least we have something in place that we can work from, and we can ratchet it up as time goes on, which is actually part of what was agreed to in Paris, that in 5 years we can look at what everyone agreed to and start to make more commitments.
Today we're speaking with Bonnie Cohen and John Shank, co-directors of the new documentary, An Inconvenient Sequel. They had to update the film after Donald Trump pulled out of that Paris climate agreement. You can find the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and actually we'll play it after the break, and then you can see the film. It opens throughout the country on August 4th. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you're involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. The lines are full, so if you get a busy signal, you may want to send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the fight to save our public lands. I hope you can join us for that. Today, we are talking about the new documentary, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Almost 11 years ago, Al Gore released An Inconvenient Truth, which started a very important national conversation about climate change. An Inconvenient Sequel documents riveting image of climate change around the globe. And then it also looks at the first film's predictions that have come true: shrinking ice sheets, rising sea levels, global rise in temperatures. The film opens across the country on August 4th, and you can find more information about the film. There are links at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Bonnie Cohen, co-director of An Inconvenient Sequel. She's an award-winning producer and director. John Shank is also co-director of An Inconvenient Sequel. He's an award-winning director of photography. Bonnie and John have made so many incredible films, and you can find them at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to add to the conversation, if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. A phone line will come open in just a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I'm very well aware of the fact that your guests may not know this is not their expertise. It's more a political question than a science environmental question, but I'm wondering if they have any thoughts on, given the hypothetical, if Al Gore had rightfully gotten elected and sworn in as president, do they think he would have been able to, and if he would have been willing to push those policies as president?
I think everyone in the theater was thinking that last night, Ruth Ann.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that in a way, watching Al Gore in this film is a reminder of kind of, you know, it seems like a throwback now, when our country had leaders who were driven by a sense of wanting to make the world a better place and, you know, wanting to go into public service for altruistic reasons. And, you know, Al comes from a a lineage of political and public service. His father was a senator, and Al started in the House of Representatives as a young man. You never know how history would have gone if things had gone the other way in the Supreme Court in 2000. Of course, we do know that Al was a significant proponent of the environment going way back, even to the 1970s. In the film, we tell the story of an incredible moment in NASA history, actually, where Al was leading the NASA initiatives from the White House as vice president in the late 90s, and he was part of a team that was helping develop a satellite that would be launched into space that would give scientists very accurate data about the energy in and the energy out, the energy balance of planet Earth that can be seen from space. Ultimately, that satellite was nixed by the incoming administration in 2000, the project was put on hold. And once Obama was elected, Al immediately went to the White House, explained to President Obama the importance of the satellite, and it was launched. And so, you know, who is president, who is in the White House really does matter. And one has to assume that Al would have been thinking seriously about the environment as president. But on the other hand, what Bonnie and I really noticed about Al is that he rose from the ashes of that defeat and did something that I'm not sure many people can do, which is he reinvented himself. He asked himself, what is important in my life? What do I think is important for the planet? And he really created the second career that arguably is more important than the political work he did prior to the climate work, and became an incredible leader in climate activism, and has, as Bonnie was describing earlier, has really helped train many of the activists that do climate work around the world.
Talking about what is politically possible, what did you both learn about the powerful interests, the gas and oil industries, the Koch brothers? The Guardian had a piece a couple weeks ago called Just 100 Companies Are Responsible for 71% of Global Emissions. There's a lot of dialogue about how the onus tends to be on the individual. Change your light bulb, ride a bike, don't eat meat, eat less meat. All of that stuff is good. But what about the focus on the big players like Exxon, Shell, BP, and Chevron, who are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1998? And this new report that came out from the Climate Accountability Institute found that if fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and this year, global temperatures will rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. You can't even comprehend that.
You know, where do we even begin with that one? There's a scene in the film, actually. We don't dive into it with too much depth, but you do. Al Gore goes to meet with Eric Schneiderman, who's the Attorney General of New York, because there's an ongoing case against ExxonMobil having to do with what kind of knowledge Exxon knew of what fossil fuel emissions could do to were doing to the environment and contributing to man-made climate change. And it turns out that there's documentation dating back to the 1970s that indicates that there were scientists that were on the payroll at Exxon who, you know, uncovered just this kind of information, that yes, there is a specific connection between fossil fuel emissions and climate change. And what's being investigated is how and why Exxon would have buried that information, and what their response, and therefore what are they responsible for. So yes, I mean, there's a cadre of companies that are doing a huge amount of damage to the environment. Slowly but surely, investigations are going on around the country, and hopefully there's going to be some justice.
And there are three lawsuits have been filed by the city of Imperial Beach, San Mateo, and Marin counties against Chevron, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, BP, and Royal Dutch Shell to pay for the projected effects of rising seas along California's coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even the shareholders themselves of Exxon are starting to rise up against its own company's policies. One thing that we learned that's interesting is that, the facts that you lay out, that if we keep burning fossil fuels at the rate that we've been burning them for the last 20, 30 years, you know, temperature goes up, carbon dioxide fills the atmosphere, temperature goes up, there's devastating effects get more and more intense. But one thing that scientists are starting to realize is that it's impossible to burn those fuels, because if we keep pumping pollution into our atmosphere at the rate that we've been doing, eventually the very economy that is driven by those fossil fuels will collapse, mm-hmm. and there will be no economy to burn those fossil fuels anymore. So it's kind of this it's one of these conundrums that Wall Street is starting to take notice of in a big way. And there's this new concept emerging in the financial markets, which is subprime carbon assets. Mm-hmm. The idea that these oil reserves and coal reserves in the ground that these oil companies count as their part of their company's value are actually worth pennies on the dollars compared to what they say they are. And there is a type of bubble that exists in carbon investment, and nobody knows exactly when it will burst, but there's starting to be a sense in the financial communities that it will.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Ruthann. Let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you guys for a wonderful film. I was at the event last night, and that film, together with Chasing Coal, which you interviewed the people on that one, Rose, was just two amazing films about climate.
And Chasing Ice.
I just wanted to say, you know, in the interview, aside, you know, it shows just not only his passion, but his generosity and his sense of humor. It's a wonderful film about Al as well as about climate. And he says afterwards in the talk to the audience, you know, the Stone Age didn't change because there was a lack of stones. It changed because there was something that was better. So he was talking about, yeah, we do have carbon, fossil fuels, and so on, but there's a better method to change this equation, not just because there's fossil fuels to have, but there's a better method to do it with. I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Sure.
Very interesting analogy. And the other thing is that when watching the film, you know what's going to happen after the climate accord is reached. And even though you put that thing at the end about Trump withdrawing from the Paris Accord, What's missing, and it's not a fault of your film, is how the other countries doubled down and said, well, the hell with the United States, in a sense. If you're not going to do it, we're going to do it on our own. And maybe you have it in the film, but I kind of missed it if you did.
Well, we don't have the wording, but what you see at the end of the film is a montage of people and companies. First, it starts out as Americans, and then it broadens out to people around the world who are doing this work and effectively, from a visual perspective, doing the doubling down on their efforts to meet the commitments of the Paris Climate Accord. So we don't say it explicitly, but you experience it at the end of the film, and you have this, hopefully, this overwhelming sense that there's just a continuation of people joining the movement and rising up to make sure that we, as a planet, as a civilization, do the right thing.
Thank you, Mo, for calling. Today we're speaking with Bonnie Cohen and John Shank, co-directors of an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, a new documentary about Al Gore and his travels around the globe to raise awareness about climate change. He's doing these incredible climate leadership trainings all over the world, and that's also part of the film. There's incredible footage in the film. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and it opens across the country on August 4th. Let's go next to Kala in San Francisco. Hi, Kala. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Aloha. Good morning. I was just wondering if the filmmakers were aware in the research of this film I used to use in the late 90s, I think it was, in Pacific Islander Studies. I think it's called Sinking Island, where the islands in some of the islands, or at least one of the islands in Micronesia, was, well, it looked like it was sunk, but actually was, of course, the rise of the sea level had risen, and they had petitioned Australia to move their culture of thousands of years over into Australia, and they were refused. But I guess that didn't. And talked about how they were trying to get Washington to pay attention, and they did. They brought their climatologists over there. So it now that it's Miami is underwater, whatever. Now that all of a sudden it's coming closer to home, I was just wondering if they were aware, or even if Al Gore would, that this was a problem already going on in the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call, and we'll make note of that film. I had not heard of it. We were aware of this issue in general. There are countries around the world that are the island nations of the world that are highly vulnerable to sea level rise. Bonnie and I made a film that came out in 2012 called The Island President. It was a portrait of Mohamed Nasheed, who was the first democratically elected leader of the Maldives, an Indian Ocean country of 1,200 tiny islands that are just a meter off of the sea. And you can just see when you look at them, especially from the air, just how vulnerable they are to sea level rise. And indeed, this even 5 years ago when we were shooting there, already the seawater was leaching into the groundwater supply and people had to evacuate some of the islands. And Nasheed was trying to make a splash at the Copenhagen Climate Conference in 2009 to try to bring awareness to the island nations of the world. In our new film, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, we do have a section where Al Gore points out that the Maldives, the country of Kiribati, is also a very vulnerable country, and they have purchased land, I believe, in Australia to move their inhabitants. These things that just seem like science fiction that never could happen are happening. And I think that's the reason that after Trump's announcement, you saw this global community gather together and really double down on this issue, because it's becoming an emotional issue in a way that it never has before. I think, for people like us, kind of middle-aged people who remember this issue in the 80s and 90s, it always seemed difficult for people to connect to it and to make it personal and make it emotional. But that threshold has been crossed, and now it is in line with the great social issues of our time, like civil rights, like gay rights.
Well, thank you, Kala. And again, that film is The Island President, and I hope you can see that. I'm glad that you raised this, because it reminded me of the sad scene in your film about what happened in the Philippines.
Oh, yes.
And you traveled there, and you filmed Al Gore meeting with a heartbroken young man who survived the typhoon there but lost so many of his family members and loved ones. They had to create a makeshift grave. I mean, in one scene, you see one man holding on to a ledge. The wind is just going so fast and strong, he almost is forced to let go.
Yeah, this typhoon, which was known as Typhoon Haiyan, which hit land in the Philippines in a city called Tacloban. It was the most serious storm to ever hit land, and it just wiped the place out. I mean, there isn't a person living in Tacloban that's still there that doesn't have at least one, if not, God forbid, more loved ones that they lost to this storm. And it just came out of nowhere. It came fast and furious because the ocean temperatures affect the storms, and as the ocean temperatures rise, the storms get more severe. And these are some of our first real climate refugees that are being affected in a way, often in parts of the world that don't have a tremendous amount of resources, and they're left with the detritus of these experiences. So Al Gore not only goes to Tacloban to meet with those on the front lines of these problems, which is very emotional and tragic. And he actually, there's a scene that we shot that is not in the film where he actually goes into the home of a woman and her children who were flooded up to the ceiling, and she had to kind of figure out a way to get her kids out of the house.
People were actually punching the rooftops.
There's a scene where the mayor of Tacloban actually climbs to the top of a resort, a hotel, and they punch through the ceiling so that they can get high enough above the water to remain secure. But the other thing that Al does in Tacloban, in the Philippines, that's also kind of very emotional, is that he has one of his climate trainings there. He wants to be able to offer the people who are experiencing these climate tragedies the knowledge and the expertise to know what's happening to them, know what the facts are, know what the solutions can be, and start to be part of the solution.
What struck you just quickly about being at that training? What did you hear from young Filipinos after they took that?
We were just amazed. As Al points out in the film, Pope Francis's encyclical on climate change, which he wrote after becoming pope a couple of years ago, says, you know, lays out the case very clearly, and it's without dispute that the most intense detrimental effects of climate change will be visited upon the world's poorest people.
This is an encyclical he actually handed to Donald Trump when they met.
Yeah, and this is very moving to the people of the Philippines because they're a country where a lot of people still live in poverty, and when you see these young Filipinos who know firsthand and, like Bonnie said, had direct experience with this incredible storm that hit their coast, going through the training and getting the information so that they can go to their community leaders and say, "Hey, wait a minute, we want to be, you know, we know what the pitfalls here. We want to be on the leading edge of the solutions." Another scene that didn't quite make it into the film, but that we were amazed to see, is actually the solar farms that are now popping up in the Philippines and the move towards sustainable energy there, because they see it as an existential cause.
You can't help, when you talk like that about this, you can't help but think about the countries that are affected by climate change and war. Mm-hmm. Places that Al Gore cannot go. Iraq, Afghanistan.
Syria.
Yeah, another point that Al makes in the film that was eye-opening to us is that, you know, very rarely in kind of the 24-hour news cycle does the media have the time and the resources to connect the dots between current events and the larger climate story. And it turns out that just so much of what we see on the nightly news is at least partly due to climate change. For example, the civil war in Syria is at least in part related to the fact that there is a once in a thousand year drought going on in Syria that led farmers and people who lived in the countryside, who normally made their living off the land, could not do so anymore because of the drought, moved into the cities, and that initially led to the tension that existed in the cities, which broke out in civil war, which led to the refugee crisis in Europe. And it's those kinds of things that Al has the time, because this is a single issue that he focuses all his time on, to talk to experts and bring people from different walks of life together and talk about kind of issues, how geopolitical issues affect each other, and is able to kind of put clearly into his slideshow in this amazingly effective way to connect those dots that the media doesn't normally do.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kala. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for such an incredible program. I would like to say that I'm a union member, and my union at UC, UPTE, University of Professional and Technical Employees, we passed a resolution at our annual convention in January to divest from energy transfer partners and also from the financial institutions that fund it. And this is something that all of us who are fighting climate change and who are really serious about it have to take into consideration, that we are funding it by our pension funds, because the University of California has the retirement plan is invested in several of these financial institutions that are funding the pipelines that are going to be destroying our water. They're funding it to the tune of billions of dollars, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America. And we really need to get rid of the profit motive and burst that bubble once and for all, because we are in climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention that. I'm also half Chilean, and I want to say that although I applaud the solar initiatives of Chile does not have a very good environmental policy when it comes to the destruction of the environment. They have the coal mining, the gold mining, which is destroying the water in the northern part of Chile, a very dry area, and also they've been pushing massive hydroelectric dams, they've been destroying the forestry. The forestry companies control the whole southern area of Chile, and also criminalize the Mapuche indigenous people who are trying to defend their country and their territories. So I just feel that it's really important to mention that.
Yes, very important, Lisa.
Thank you
for calling. We have just a couple minutes left. There's one man in your film, a Republican mayor of Georgetown, Texas, at the forefront of alternative energy. That was a really interesting one. And then someone who didn't make it in the film is Jerry Taylor, who was with the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. And I understand he's changed his views.
Yeah, you know, it became really important to John and me to look at, you know, Al Gore has a lot of conversations across the aisle trying to, you know, in an effort really to take the climate crisis out of the realm of politics, make it less of a partisan issue, because it didn't start out that way. It's become that way. It's evolved over the years, and this is really our existential crisis to grapple with. So there's a scene in the film, as you refer to, where Al Gore goes to the heart of oil country, Georgetown, Texas. It's a conservative Republican town. And he meets with a mayor who has made the decision, really for economic reasons, to take the whole town carbon neutral. And over time, he's getting wind out of Amarillo, Texas, and he's got solar panels going. It's a town, it's a city of 65,000 people. So he's actually accomplished a carbon neutral city. It's the largest carbon neutral city in the country, in the hotbed of oil country. So it's really exciting, and they have a wonderful discourse. They don't agree on politics. Dale Ross is a Trump supporter. He's a conservative Republican, but he and Al Gore come together around the issues of alternative energy, and they agree that it's an economically viable way forward. So it's kind of an exciting thing for viewers, because they can see how we can, you know, if you feel siloed in your point of view, you can see how that's not necessarily going to be the future. And you know, you also mentioned Jerry Taylor. You know, we didn't include him in the film in the end, but we witnessed and filmed a very interesting conversation between Al Gore and Jerry Taylor. Jerry used to run energy, actually, at the Cato Institute, which was responsible for all the, you know, information going out from that think tank, that conservative think tank on the climate crisis. And so a lot of the climate denial came out of there. And over time, I think, you know, it seems like Jerry kind of looked in the mirror and looked at the world he was going to be leaving his grandchildren, and he's flipped on the issue and has decided that that is not what he's going to stand for, and also for economic reasons and reasons also having to do with the survival of the planet. He's now talking out the other side. So it was actually very exciting to hear the two of them talk. And he mentioned to Al that there are quite a few Republicans in the House and Senate that are sitting on the cusp of also flipping over on this issue. And it's just a matter of the right time where they feel like they can actually do it publicly.
Bonnie Cohen and John Shank are co-directors of An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and the film opens nationwide on August 4th. It's opening in hundreds of theaters across the country, right? This is a huge opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bonnie and I were talking about this last night. You know, this film is being released by Paramount Pictures, which released the first Inconvenient Truth, an incredible, storied film studio in Hollywood, and we're just honored to have this film being released in 500 screens starting August 4th, which for a documentary is amazing. It's an amazing opportunity to have a national conversation about this issue, and we're thrilled to be working with Paramount.
Well, congratulations to both of you, and thank you for coming in
today.
Thank
you, Rose.
Thank you,
Rose. Really happy to be here.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can listen to past shows and be sure to sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Sanaa Saleem for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.